And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Tom Goodridge about his book Hellstorm and the consequent world that we are now living in post-World War II times. After the quote good war unquote was won by the Allies. It's a really horrendous story of the atrocities that took place during this time. And of course, this is something that just continued really into our times, and we find ourselves in a very bizarre situation and predicament right now. The Europeans of the world, but there were a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, Tom, here in terms of the backdrop to the war, and of course we can get into talking more about your book here as well, because there's so many interesting and important aspects, and we can certainly also take this into the modern world a bit later again. But what would you say about the backdrop to the war? It's kind of a question I alluded to a little bit earlier, but I think people have a different view of what the war was about as opposed to when the war actually was happening. And what it was about. What would you say to the ideology behind this, of why this war was fought? What was the main reason? I guess there's always multiple things. It's not only the one thing, but if there are a couple or the main issues, why did this happen? And what was this fought for, Tom?
I think my own personal opinion is that it was fought to make the world safe for world Jewry. The war was originated between the World Jewish Congress and Germany in 1933. The Jews met in enclave in Amsterdam in 1933 and basically declared economic war against Germany after Hitler was elected to the chancellorship. When Germany refused to bow down, then that's when the screws were tightened on, and we had one episode after another until Germany's invasion of Poland and its attempt to stop the massacre of Germans living in Danzig and areas in Poland. That was the original onset of war. Basically, as I mentioned, I think earlier, Germany was trying to be independent of world Jewry. They had said Hitler promised that he would give Germans their respect back and would make Germany flourish once more, and more than good to his word, he did that in such a remarkably short amount of time. We're talking several years, and Germany was not only rehabilitated, but Germany suddenly started leading the world again, leading the world in virtually everything. And this, of course, was something that the Jewish establishment just simply couldn't have. You've got the United States in the depths of depression, as were it was most of Europe. And here you have this beacon of prosperity in Germany. That's not going to make it. Obviously, those who are listening know something about the banker control of Europe. Mm-hmm, yeah. So it probably makes great sense. But that, in essence, is as simple as I can make it.
So Germany managed to throw themselves off from the shackles of the system, the banking system that was attempting to and was controlling the world at that stage to a large degree, and they were successful, and is that why eventually the whole world basically turned on Germany to destroy them for once and for all? Because it seems to me like there was a model of success really that managed to perform this, and consequently that's why they've been so tremendously demonized, so that people have a psychological issue, an imperative to even look at what kind of system they were running. That's how things, how I view it from my perspective. What do you make of that, Tom?
Well, I think we're back to propaganda, and you're right. You would think that this shining example of prosperity and success would draw people in, and of course it would. That's what the power brokers knew. And so we have this deliberate attempt to vilify Germany throughout, from 1933 all the way up to 1945 and beyond, of course. This deliberate attempt, especially the persecution, so-called, of Jews. Basically, Hitler's approach was to replace Jews in various aspects of German life with Germans for a change. How about that? A novel idea. In the media, in communications especially, in finance, in the economy, in academia, in every aspect of Germany, he wanted Germans back in these positions, as it should have been. And of course, that's where the the propaganda begins. I even begin that way in my book, the wild, hysterical propaganda against Germany even before the war started.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
1930s, American Jewish script writers are talking about how Germany needs to be destroyed, and not a bullet has been fired yet. And so the propaganda war began long before the first bullet was fired. And then, of course, after the fighting began, then all bets were off, and everybody started believing the propaganda because it was the smart thing to do at the time. We were at war. But propaganda, as I point out in Hellstorm, in the words of the folks themselves, got millions of people killed. It got millions of people raped. It got millions of people tortured. Millions of people died, were raped, tortured to death, and yet so few people actually knew of what happened. That's the reason, that's the purpose. The entire purpose of this book is to let the world know what happened, what really happened when a nation defied the forces of evil and basically stood up and said, we're going to be free. We're going to be free. Live with it. And this is what happened when the propaganda machine brought together almost the entire power of the earth against this one nation. And despite all that, Germany still put up a hell of a fight, as you guys know, in Europe. But the things that were done to Germany just are beyond. There's nothing military about what I was talking about, the rape. This is all savage sadism. This is a vendetta. This is a vicious, vindictive attack against every German woman, every German child, trying to destroy Germany.
And look at how they've continued to do that, by the way. I mean, every time in the media, and I get so mad when I see that in Hollywood and everything else, of these TV shows and movies, and it's just like the continuous pointing out of that these are the greatest villains that ever lived. I mean, the lies are so monumental. I don't understand how people can't see this, you know?
Yeah, for instance, most of your listeners probably think the world's greatest nautical disasters were either the Lusitania or the Titanic. A lot is made out of the Titanic, of course. I think Titanic, 1,500 people died when the ship went down, and I think the Lusitania, 1,200 people. That's a lot of folks. Most people don't know, however, that the world's greatest nautical disasters occurred at the end of World War II, when Soviet submarines deliberately sank German refugee ships that were loaded, packed, carrying German women and children to try to escape the Soviet army in late 1944 and early 1945, deliberately sank by Soviet submarines. The Wilhelm Gustloff was a former German passenger liner turned into a refugee ship. 8,000 women and men, actually 9,000 men, women, and children, mostly women and kids, of course, and old people, were on that ship. When it was sank, roughly 8,000 died. Very few people survived that. There are other ships that went down with 5,000 on board, 7,000. Several other ships went down with thousands of people dying. These are the worst nautical disasters in history. But because it was Germans dying, there's very little made out of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very little made out of that. God forbid, if it was Jews that died in that, we would never hear the end of it. So many Jews being killed deliberately, or Americans even.
Yeah.
So I talk about that, the hypocrisy. The Russians knew that these were refugee ships. These weren't mistaken identities. There were no German ships on the Baltic at the time of this size. So they knew very well these were refugee ships, and yet it was their ambition to kill the people wholesale. For instance, Americans. We like to think Americans as being good-natured GIs in war. They love kids. They're always throwing Hershey bars to children as they proceed through a German city from a Sherman tank, chewing their bubble gum. But mostly, the Americans were not a lot different than the Soviet counterparts over on the Eastern front. They were mowing down men and boys who were trying to surrender in the Home Guard. They were just shooting them dead. The best that could hope for would, if you surrendered, would be to be taken to the rear and there killed. But anyway, it was a massacre.
Yeah.
In spite of American movies about taking prisoners, lots of them. No, it was Black Flag. It was No Quarter. It was only at the end of the war, when millions of German soldiers surrendered with the armistice, that then Americans took prisoners. There was nothing else they could do. It'd be a terrific slaughter field, of course, if it was. But anyway, Eisenhower, an American icon, also an American president after the war. A lot of people still love this guy. I like Ike. I actually come from the state where Eisenhower was from himself, Kansas, in the middle of America. Mm. And I grew up loving Eisenhower. Little did I know that he is one of the greatest mass murderers in history.
Yep.
He allowed anywhere from 800,000 to 1.5 million helpless, disarmed German POWs to die after the war from starvation, from dehydration, from just simply dying from the elements, dying from disease. Eisenhower gave them no help whatsoever. When the International Red Cross tried to bring in food from Switzerland, Eisenhower refused. He turned the trains back. When other people tried to get water to these people, Eisenhower forbade it. In fact, many of the concentration camps that he stuck these poor people in, there was a river running right outside the barbed wire, but they could not get to it. Eisenhower preferred to allow them to die from dehydration. When men could not get out of the holes they were in, they were bulldozed with they were bulldozed over, drowning in the mud. And the very few people know about this. The common belief, the common narrative of World War II is the victor's narrative, of course. It's the good war. It's the greatest generation. It's American and British soldiers rolling in from the West, and the glorious allies of Stalin rolling in from the East. Maybe they were a little rougher than the Americans and British, but still, it was a united effort to destroy evil, to kill Hitler and Nazism once and for all. These evil rats who had enslaved Europe and put millions of Jews to death, innocent Jews to death in death camps. That's the common narrative. Americans and British, they came with the Russians. They saw, they conquered, they freed the people who were yet alive in the death camps. And then they turned right around and rebuilt Europe, the Europe they had destroyed. That's the narrative. What's left out, of course, are the things we're talking about right now. The slaughter of prisoners, the sinking of refugee ships, the wholesale rape of German women, the Allied terror bombing, one city after another gone up in a vortex, a tornado, a fire, an effort to burn, incinerate every man, woman, and child in those cities below. There's plenty more. For instance, Americans have been torturing people for quite a long time. It just didn't begin in Abu Ghraib with those fiendish photographs of these American thugs and hillbillies torturing helpless Iraqi naked men as they roll on the ground, and dogs bite them, and they have electrodes attached to their fingers and penises and other parts of their body. It didn't just begin there. It began a long time even before that, especially during World War II. Americans got a very good rolling start about torture after the war was over and there was no longer any threat of American prisoners being reciprocated, in other words, being killed. Americans basically turned hell loose in Europe. Jews who came in with American soldiers, G2, called intelligence. This is basically the group that come in and try to get, are supposedly trying to get facts and figures and find out secrets of the Germans, came in. Basically, they just came in to torture. This was nothing about, how much information can you get out of a man after you've beaten him nearly to death and squished his testicles, knocked out every tooth in his head? He's going to say anything on earth that you want him to say.
Right. Yeah.
But this was a program. This is a concerted program to inflict as much sadistic torture on Germans, not necessarily Nazis and not just soldiers, civilians as well, even women, possible.
Well, exactly. And that's a really good point as well, because it doesn't, and it's kind of alludes to what I mentioned earlier, it doesn't mean that everyone even was a national socialist. But again, even if they were, that of course doesn't justify it. And of course, we're trying to deconstruct the fantasy image that had been built up around, the political ideology for, 70 plus years here now. But nonetheless, it means that they are doing these towards people who have nothing to do with this, and that's where I think people need to understand that the tremendous atrocities they just did it. It didn't matter who you were or what your beliefs were or whatever. It just, if you're German, that is the only criteria we need to do this kind of behavior against you, right?
Yes, yes. What role did an 8-year-old child that was raped to death have in the war?
Right.
What role does an old grandmother who was in her prime well before World War I, what role does she have being burned to death in a German city? What role did she have in this war right here? Knitting her scarves. There was no distinction. People who like to say that there was some distinction are liars. Americans originally tried to bomb military targets in Germany. That's a fact. Early in the war, daylight bombing, pinpoint bombing. There were just too many of them being shot out of the air, and British RAF general bomber Harris, Arthur Harris, persuaded them that, hey, you better join us and just start saturation bombing, basically terror bombing at night. You're losing too many people. And here's another aspect of the air war, so-called air massacre. Let's call it what it really was. Targets of opportunity. That's a very nice sounding phrase. What it really means is shoot anything that moves in Germany. That was the orders, the American fighter pilots and the British. What they would do is a sadistic turkey shoot. That's all it was. It was a video game, an early day video game. Passenger trains full of people, women and children, shot up, bombed, blasted by the fighters. Buses, boats, ferries, farmers in their fields, horses, cattle, women on bikes, even kids in schoolyards were attacked by American fighter pilots. You know, after Dresden, and we talk about this. I talk about this in the book. I talk about everything I'm talking about right now in the book. The people talk about it. Dresden, when the people are trying the following day to escape this burnt out hulk that was one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
Yeah.
The day before, are trying to flee with their pathetic packages and bags on their backs. The next day, American pilots showed up in broad daylight and started shooting them down. Pilots, dive bombing, shooting them, shooting women, children, men, everybody. And believe me, they knew who they were shooting. It's very clear. They were even shooting animals that had escaped from the zoo. One zookeeper just cried when they shot the last giraffe that was trying to escape through the park in Dresden. He talked about the brave American pilot. It was the most vicious thing. Some people like to tie a pretty bow around this and say, well, you're just pointing out the bad things about World War II. I think this was all pretty bad, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I don't see anything good about it.
No.
But anyway, let me say this also, that the expulsion, it seems like the least of all the crimes because people were just forced to move. After the war, there was an attempt, an agreement between the Europeans, the European allies, that is, the British and then the French and the Americans and, of course, the Russians, to expel from Central Europe all Germans. In other words, they were going to have to go back to Germany and get out of the countries they had lived in some places for 500 years. Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, Romania, all these countries expelled their German population, and roughly 11 million people were forced to move. Of the 11 million people, it's an estimated 1 to 2 million people died in this migration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's been written about, but you know, these are real people that are dying. These aren't just statistics. These are women who are watching their children die in their arms as they starve to death because there's no food. These are people who, before they're expelled from there, are sometimes captured and hung upside down from lampposts, then covered in gas and set on light like a flaming torch. It isn't just a managed expulsion where people have to go. Sometimes they only had 5 minutes warning to get out of their homes. Homes they had lived in, their ancestors had lived there for generations. You're given 5 minutes to pack and get out, or we'll kill you. And of course, people had to get out. They left with almost nothing. That's almost guaranteeing that they're going to die on the way to Germany. And of course, millions did. Hundreds of thousands died. There are also things in the book that are small, or seemingly small, in the great picture of crimes. Things like one Jewish major who's with the Americans, and obviously he's living it up in Germany, post-war Germany, right after Germans surrendered. It's the humiliation and degradation that the Germans were forced to endure from the Americans, especially the Americans. They seem to have a penchant for this. I don't know why. I am an American. I don't feel this way, but obviously a lot of them did. This Jewish major, one of the things he loved to do the most was ride around with his driver in the Jeep, American Jeep, and knowing the Germans had no clothes. Basically, they're down to the last when they try to go do some shopping or go to a church in the immediate months after the war. They put on good clothes. And this guy knew that this was all the clothes they had, the only good clothes. Well, he loved to drive by with his cane, one of the old-fashioned hooked canes, and grab him by the ankle and trip him into mud puddles, or force his driver to drive into mud puddles to splatter the people their clothes. That's pretty petty. That's pretty, yeah. And yet it's driving home that humiliation, that degradation, denazification. It was it's a terrible thing because it sounds real simple. Stop believing in the Nazi ideology. Well, it's not that easy. It's basically, I think it was Eisenhower who suggested that 50,000 German Nazis, upper Nazis, were supposed to be killed outright. And I believe it was 100,000, he said, German soldiers, officers, should be killed. And probably they did that. I don't have any proof that they did it. There's nothing, I have not seen any documents on that. But that's what denazification is. It's basically killing off the people who were in the Nazi party or sending them to a Jewish-run death camp in Poland, especially in Poland. This is some of the most depraved, despicable crimes ever committed on the face of the planet. Sending Germans, men, women, and children, to these death camps run by Jews in Poland. And, there's nothing you can say except nightmare when you talk about something like this, because you've got these individuals that are hate-filled anyway. And then they get to live out their sadistic pleasures. For instance, lining up a bunch of Germans and picking out the blondest German and beating him to death, forcing him to sing, first of all, the Horst Wessel march song. And as he's singing it, screaming at him louder and beating him, as you're saying it, with a chair until he's finally dead. And forcing people, I'll tell you what, I won't describe some of the things that were done there. It is from hell. Nobody could think of such terrible things except people from hell. Right. The things they did to these people, if you don't read or if you don't understand any aspect of this book, understand that. Then know what we may be facing very soon ourselves. Any people who could do that to these people could do that to us. See what our future is. Understand this. And work like hell to make sure that they never, ever get control of us again. This is what we've got to do, because this is what they did to the Germans. And I don't see us as being any different. Well, I mean, let me give you one terrible example, and then I'll stop with that. One fellow, just a German, he had to dig his own grave. The Jews forced him to recite something. He didn't do it well. They grabbed a big, fat toad hopping on the ground and stuffed it down his throat. Of course, he strangled to death. Then they kicked him in the grave and buried him. Believe me, that's depraved, but there's so much depravity in this thing. I have to say, I wasn't the first one to find the death camps in Poland for the Germans. That was John Sack, who I quote extensively in the latter chapters, who wrote An Eye for an Eye, and himself a Jew, and I think himself ashamed of what some people of his religion, of his race, did. Truly, the savagery at Abu Ghraib was probably child's play compared to this. The torture, for instance, Leni Riefenstahl was probably, well, she is one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. Certainly, she was the greatest German filmmaker. She was the lady responsible for the documentary film Triumph of the Will, which showed the rise of Nazi, National Socialist Germany as it came to power and its grip upon the people, how they loved it, how they sprang to it, how they cried when Hitler appeared, because he was the savior. He was the one that turned everything around and made them feel good about themselves again. Triumph of the Will by Leni Riefenstahl, who was not a Nazi party member anyway, herself. She also did the movie Olympia, a beautiful movie on the Olympic in 1936. Well, Leni was grabbed by the Americans, of course, and tortured, imprisoned, I think, 7 different times, which is torture in itself. But beat up. I'm sure Leni was raped. I don't think she remarks on being raped at all, but certainly she was. Leni must have seen some terrible things, because I've got quotes by people who did see bad things. People, for instance, a Jew questioning Germans in a courtyard. It's just an example I'm going to use. And they're all in line, and basically he's going along the line and said, "Were you in the Nazi party?" And a German immediately says, "No." And the guy says, "You liar," and beats him, knocks his teeth out right there on the spot. He comes to the next German. He said, "Were you in the Nazi party?" The guy hesitates a bit and says, "No." He said, "You liar too." And he beats him up and knocks him around. And then he comes to the end of the line after, you know, beating and knocking teeth out of everybody. And finally the guy says, "Yes, I was in the Nazi party." And I believe he killed him right there on the spot. So yeah. If people see this, this is, for instance, women were raped and Americans could see them right through the mirrors as American military policemen who would rape the women when they came in. People like Leni Riefenstahl, beautiful German women. I go on. I'm probably trying to tell the entire story here, and it's impossible. But the torture that came after the war is something that's not very well known. The depravity, the sadistic savagery. As terrible as it is, there are little moments of miracles in the book. For instance, this poor German. I think he might have been a soldier. I'm not sure what he was, but he had been beaten up so badly, knocked around for days on end, and when an American guard finally took him back to his cell for the 100th time, the man was barely able to get through the door, and the guard kicked him in the butt and knocked him into the darkened cell. And the man describes himself laying there. He said, "I wanted to kill myself, but there was no way to do it." And he was thinking about the absence of God. There could be no God, because it's... And while he was thinking about this, of course, every bone in his body hurts. He heard his door open very, very slowly and very slightly. And then he saw a figure come in from into the darkness and close the door behind him. And he came up very close to him and he said, "Shh." And out of his pocket, he pulled a couple of boiled potatoes and put it in the man's hand. And then he walked out. And as he left, the man could see it was a little American private. He said, "I saw what happened. Here, take these." And it was a little American soldier. So it is not all evil. It is not all... Enough of it is, but well, there are... Yes.
Isn't it that's the way they've kind of painted it out, and that's... Another one of the major atrocities here that we're talking about, but it's like that there wasn't this extreme vilification of and the one-sidedness of it, that these are and I mean people still walk around with this conception today that these are the National Socialist is the epitome of all evil. It's the devil incarnate on earth, and this kind of allows you to do anything you can, whether these people are humans or not, that deserve you know, to be treated fairly and everything else. And the immense atrocities, it's just such, it's such a difficulty to wrap your head around it. You know, as I've been reading your book and you go through it and you just like, it's unfathomable. You don't comprehend how this could be done, but nonetheless, it has been done. And the cover up of it is just, oh man, it's such a difficult time to try to appeal to people and make them realize and understand, you know, why this has been done and in whose name and what the true intention of it was. And I think the people are, one of the biggest things is that they're blinded by so much propaganda over the years that they're incapable of seeing this from any kind of objective point of view, which makes it just that much more difficult. But I think to continuing to it's good to talk about the big picture, but kind of what you've done now, to continue to look at the small incidences, the examples of a soldier's life or how a mother was treated or whatever, is so essential to get to kind of get that overview and picture that these are not the most evil people in the world. This is the other side of the war, and they were fighting for their beliefs. They were fighting for their system. They were doing what they considered to be right. And that's it's such a difficult thing, I think, to communicate to people, because we're so propagandized. We're so immersed in these kinds of messages through you know, movies and through films, and let's face it, the majority of people, I think, they're not bookworms. They don't go and read the totems of the World War II in the library, and even if they did, they would of course get the you know, get the propaganda version. But it's these incremental things that they're getting it through the Schindler's List, they're getting it through you know, the Monuments Men or whatever, like this slew and endless barrage of movies and you know, History Channel documentaries. And that is a very difficult thing to pierce through, isn't it, Tom?
It is. You know, we probably both accepted the victor's version of World War II when we were kids, because let's face it, we were kids. We weren't rocket scientists. It was easier. It's easier to believe what's being believed by everyone else. It doesn't take any work. And that's where we come in, because we grow up, Henrik and Tom, and others, thousands, millions, just like us. We grow up and we develop a soul and a conscience. And we suddenly see that, how can this be good? Even if they were the most evil creatures on earth, how is that being good to turn right around and commit enormous evils against them? Some people never get that. They never understand that distinction. They go on hating what they're told to hate. They never allow their soul to explore, because they don't have a soul, quite honestly. They have no conscience. They prefer to watch their sports, can you continue to shop just like they always do, and not think. It's easier that way. But thank God, there's still people like us alive that ask ourselves, wait a minute, this is not done for me. I would never do that. Who could do such a thing? Things like what we're talking about right now. Thank goodness there are people like us. And I have to say,
I think there are more as well. More people are waking up to this. They're realizing that they have been lied to all their lives. It's an extraordinary thing, you know.
And when you've been lied to, it's one thing to, I don't know about yourself, I'm assuming we're very much alike, but I get very angry when I find out I have been lied to all
me
my
too.
Life.
Yeah,
I make a much worse enemy in a situation like that than if, well, let's put it this way. I refuse to remain silent. I know the truth now, and that's what lying did to me. I feel like I have to make up for the lies. I have to make up for lost ground, because I believe them so quickly. Now they made an enemy out of me. Now I'm determined, until the day I die, to let people know what I know. That's what happens when you lie and someone finds out that you've lied, at least in my case. You know, let me say this also. It's the book is not just about one horror after another. It does have some of the war in it. And some of the things were so astonishing. That last year of war, when Germany was being invaded on all sides, some of the most heroic, magnificent fighting in the most worst of times, and yet the people I talked to, the people I researched, for instance, on the Eastern Front, you might think that here we have two opposing philosophies, National Socialism, that is European nationalism on one side, and you've got international Bolshevism on the other, communism, fighting each other. That is a two terrible enemies, obviously. And the fighting on the Eastern Front, there's never been a war like the fighting on the Eastern Front. There were very few prisoners taken. It was war to the knife and knife to the hilt, fang and tooth and claw like wolves fighting it out. But even in all of that, there were still times of humanity. Let me, Stalin and the commissars, the Jewish commissars, would bolt Soviet tank crews inside their tanks so they could not escape. They either had to win, go on to victory, but they could not retreat and they could not escape. And so when a German anti-tank unit would destroy a tank, what do? Time and time again, they tried to get these guys out. They could hear them screaming inside, dying inside. And yet they'd rush over to the tank and with their hands, they could not get the bolts off, of course. And it was frustrating, terribly frustrating. And, you know, here we are, merciless enemies, and still they're trying to save each other. And it wasn't always bad either with the Soviet troops. They weren't always killing the Germans when they captured them. It was some of the most – well, something occurred on December 24th, the night of 1944. And I had never read about this before, but just like it happened in World War One. On the Western Front of World War One, this happened on the Eastern Front. It was almost an impossible miracle. But both sides, the Soviets on one side, the Soviet soldiers, and the German Wehrmacht on the other, just decided to stop killing each other while Christmas Eve passed.
Right.
They decided to put their guns down and not kill anybody. Officers had no say in this. The men simply stopped fighting. And that night, I don't know who made the first move, but somebody came out of their filthy trenches, one side, then the other, and they started meeting right in the middle of this no man's land, an Ivan on one side and a Fritz on the other side. And they looked at each other and they realized that, my God, you don't look any different than me.
You're a human being too. Yeah, amazing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, our uniforms look alike. They're muddy, they're filthy, they're torn, they're ripped. You look like me, I look, and they traded newspapers and cigarettes and some booze and some coffee, and they traded little trinkets, and they tried to communicate with one another and talk in a broken German and broken Russian. That lasted for about 6 hours, and then they put their fires out, went back to their lines, and the next morning started shooting and killing each other again. But
that is seemingly
impossible. But so there are miracles that occur even in this terrible, terrible war. You know, there's something else. There's some bizarre things that I like to throw in all of my books. This was no exception, although this book has no humor in it. There, unlike some of my other histories where there is a spot or two of humor, I could find nothing funny at all in any of this. But this might tease you a little bit. The Russians were so unsophisticated when they finally got into Germany. In fact, one poor little Soviet soldier in Ivan, he said to one homeowner, he said, "Why you make war? You have everything. Why you fight? You got everything." In other words, all this plenty. Back in Russia, they had nothing. They had this craze for bikes. They didn't have any bicycles in Russia, apparently. So when they'd see a bike, every soldier, Russian soldier, would have to try it out. Invariably, they fell right off. They would fall right off the bikes, and they would get mad and break the bike up because they couldn't conquer this. And those who did manage to stay on generally flew right into a wall or a tree and, of course, wrecked themselves and the bike. But they loved to get the bicycles, Yuris or watches. They loved wristwatches. Apparently, they didn't have any in Russia. And it would be common to see Russian soldiers with a dozen on each arm of these Yuris, these wristwatches, and light bulbs. Like I said, they had nothing back in their villages. The Jewish Bolsheviks had sucked Russia white. In 30 and 40 years, had sucked every piece of wealth out of that country. They did not have electricity in probably most of these villages. So when they got into Germany and found light bulbs, can you imagine what they thought? There are instances of Russians actually unscrewing the light bulb very carefully and wrapping it in cloth and putting it very gently in their backpack to take back home. So they thought the light was in the bulb itself. If they took it back home, they would have light. Same with water spigots. They'd unhook those, unscrew those things, thinking that if they plugged it into the wall back home, they'd have water. That's how unsophisticated these peasant boys were.
Let me ask you about that, an extension to that, because as we said before, I mean, the Russians were very different than the Soviets. That's one thing that people have to understand. And again, considering that they murdered among the best and the brightest in the, you know, one of the greatest mass murders in the history of the world in these gulag conditions and everything else. I mean, that's just another crime that goes unrecognized really in world history as well, that people don't focus on. But if we focus then on the Bolsheviks specifically and the way they managed to destroy what they had in Russia and how destructive and detrimental this ideology were. But the Bolshevik bozos, for lack of a better term, would never have been able to make it up into space, let's say, if it wasn't for the German technology that they stole after the war. And this is, we can include America in this conversation as well, but post-war inventions and technology and stolen machinery and all these kinds of things, where they literally, you know, picked up entire machines and brought back to their respective countries and whatnot. That is an extraordinary story in itself, to realize that both America and the Soviets, where they, when they ended up, you know, in the battle of you know, conquering space and all that, none of that would have been accomplishable if it wasn't for German stolen technology. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, yes. It's that's another aspect of this attempt to crush Germany absolute forever, was seizing its brain power. It's not a secret that America got most of the scientists. They got Wernher von Braun, the famous rocketeer, the man who pioneered the V-1 and V-2 rockets. Him and his crew, they were hustled back to America, and America, of course, used these guys to get to the moon. Russia was the same thing. They took the Germans that they could get in their sphere of influence and took them back to Russia. Fact is, you're right about the slaughter of the best and the brightest of Russia, and also Poland. Don't forget the Katyn massacre, killing off the brain power. These nations on their own had a lot of creative genius, a lot of inventive individuals that were murdered, slaughtered, because they were the cream of the white crop, so to speak. And the Jews hated that, as they hate it in America to this very day, and Europe. But Operation Paperclip, that was the attempt to not only destroy Germany physically, but to destroy it, the brain power. The best and the brightest from Germany would be taken to other countries and never allowed to rebuild Germany. That goes for not just the scientists, but for the captains of industry, the entrepreneurs who created this magnificent miracle in the 1930s, this economical miracle that raised Germany from the bottom to the top of the world. These people were taken back also, as well as their secrets. Stealing the brain power of a nation, that's fairly new. World War II brought that about. Mm. It seems that of course, Germany lost the world's worst war in history. And that's what we can expect in the future. This is truly total war. We've talked about total war from the American Civil War forward, but this is total war, an attempt to attempt a genocide, an attempt to strip, deprive a nation of all of its assets, not just some of it. The Morgenthau Plan, something I haven't mentioned here. Henry Morgenthau, the Jewish Secretary of Treasury under FDR. And by the way, FDR is, in my opinion, one of the greatest war criminals in world history, period. But Henry Morgenthau was his advisor, his counselor. And of course, Roosevelt was keen to all Jewish concerns. The Morgenthau Plan was something basically to pasteurize Germany, basically taking away all of its industry, blowing them up, taking them to Russia, as Russia did. Russia took everything in its area back, down to the last nut and bolt. But in the American and British and French sectors, his plan was to destroy all industry, close all mines, basically fill in all mines, destroy railroad moving stock, trains that is, and basically turn Germany into a, I'm trying to think of a pastoral nation in Europe right now, basically turning it into a Yugoslavia, I suppose, or a Romania. Right. In other words, make them grow grain to survive. Make them grow milk cows. Make them raise milk cows. Of the 70 million people, it was estimated in Germany at the time, it was estimated that roughly two-thirds of those people, about 50 million, would die of starvation because of this Morgenthau plan. The fact is, Morgenthau's plan was still in place even after the war. Nobody ever shelved it until it was realized that we better probably leave something to the Germans, because that's all that stands between the rest of Europe and Russia is Germany. So we better do something here and make this a line in the sand, so to speak, or an American fort. And that's what they did. And Germans, after that, they did the rest themselves. The Marshall Plan, that's nice. The Americans like to make a big deal out of the Marshall Plan, rebuilding Europe afterwards. What they fail to mention is they destroyed virtually everything on purpose, and then they give back a little bit, and they call that some great magnanimity, some great gesture of the free world to Germany.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. God, it's amazing. You know, I wanted to ask you about, from like paperclip and things like that, people have a conception that, oh my God, it means that the Nazis are in America. They're controlling, America is controlled by National Socialists, right? All these kinds of conspiracies flying around about that. But if, because you talked earlier about how you kind of, you used to be patriotic, you lost confidence in your own country, you realized the war crimes that they were behind, you realized what, you know, who controlled America and how it's being used and everything else. And consequently, you begin to kind of, you know, lose that dedication to the country because you realize what it is. But how would you describe, from this perspective that we're talking about now, where we've seen communism prevail in the world, and that this, according to, well, in my view anyway, that the cultural Cold War that was consequently fought is something that prevailed in American within the governments and the institutions there, that it's slowly have become more and more part of communism as the time has gone by. Today, of course, we have, you know, the New York intellectuals, you have the neocons, you know, largely Zionist run, you have AIPAC and things like that, which, sure, they have a different twist to it, but it's still kind of, in my view, the idea of internationalism, very prominent there, of exporting, you know, the revolution, exporting democracy to other parts of the world, and forcefully even so. If you have to bomb them to smithereens to bring them the wonderful, you know, aspects of democracy, so be it then. But how do you see that this have changed in regards to communism and what America represents today, and if this is something that has permeated within the American system of politics, Tom, how do you view that?
America left me. I didn't leave America. I grew up here. I grew up loving this country. I grew up loving what this country was, not the government. I've always had an innate suspicion of the government, the large government. It's just too vast, too enormous. I'm less concerned about name or nomenclature, communism, democracy, republicanism, fascism, as I am my well-being, our well-being, the white race's well-being. I could probably live under any system as long as they looked out for our interests. That is, it's very difficult for a multicultural, multiracial mess like America is to actually isolate one group and say, we're going to look out especially for you. At least that's the way it should have been. Now, of course, that's the way it is in America. The whites are expendable, the minorities are the favored, and mostly white Americans are getting what's left over. But this government, the so-called democracy, republic that America is or was, I started sensing that I was the enemy, that I didn't matter. Yes, it was okay to put me in a uniform and ask me to go fight. But as far as their concern for me, it became pretty clear that I had no voice in this government. When they started putting a Republican and a Democrat for presidency, and nothing got better in this country. It always got worse. And I think that's what most Americans sense about what's going on right now. It never gets better. It doesn't matter who we vote for, or who we want. It never gets better. It always gets worse. There's always more wars. This country is not, does not give a damn about me. It's very clear to me. They may care about a welfare mother in New York or Chicago or Miami, but they do not really care about me.
I just can harken back a little bit to what I said earlier here, because the reason I brought that up is kind of, you know, after the Second World War, and you had people from, for example, within the economy and whatnot, like Harry Dexter White, when they helped to set up, you know, the World Bank system, you know, John Maynard Keynes and everything like that. And you had within the U.S. Treasury Department, basically riddled with you know, communist infiltrators, basically. I mean, he was charged on a number of accounts. And, you know, when McCarthy came along and all that, we know about that. And there's a tie in there, of course. But I was more kind of thinking about the internationalism that we see today, Tom, with exporting, you know, democracy to other parts of the world, or having this very staunch and militarized America that is in, you know, have more bases around the world than any other country in the history of the world ever has had, that what we've seen within America is kind of a continuation, or that communism to a certain degree, although it's not called that today, but some of the main components of that ideology kind of, they were preserved, and they still live within the type of internationalism and globalism that we see today. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Yes, I can agree with that wholeheartedly. Let me make a few comments. I think that America is the greatest force of evil in the world today. I don't think anything even comes close. Yes, I know that we're a colony. We're a satellite of Israel. I understand that. But what kind of people are we that we allow ourselves to be so easily, so quickly, so thoroughly controlled by another and vastly smaller nation? I agree. I understand it's a very powerful nation. I understand the forces in America, the AIPAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, that actually runs American foreign policy. I understand all that. But what kind of people are we that allow this to happen? Do we not think? Do we not feel? Do we not see what's happening? I cannot help but go right back to who the real culprits in this are, and I have to go look in the mirror. That will be me. That will be people I know. We're the ones that are allowing this great evil to happen. Americans, I really do believe, left to our own devices, are a good people. After all, we're a blend of all of Europe. We're Norwegians. We're Swedish. We're Germans. We're French. We're Spanish. We're Italians. We're European. At least the original stock was. And I think, at least the people I grew up with, we're a good people at heart, but we've been turned into such crazed monsters. We've become so sick, physically sick, mentally sick, that it's difficult to get control of our lives. There are so many things going on right now that we cannot nail. We're back to basically Henrik Palmgren and Red Ice Creations and other groups just like you with communications. Right now, this thing I'm talking about seems so huge and so indomitable and so enormous that we could never overcome it. And yet, I'm a student of history. I know how quickly things can happen for the better, how quickly things can turn our way. Believe me, you are a powerful person. You've got the power behind you. You're moved by something more than money and fame and fortune. You're moved by the spirit. You've got the truth behind you. Your voice just exudes strength and honesty, decency. That's a hell of an enemy to face, let me tell you. So the moment I start feeling really overwhelmed, then I just listen to people like you. And the courage I get from this, we're going to win. As you and I mentioned off air, though, I want to be around to see it. I don't want to die until I see this turnaround. And it's going to happen. I hope it happens without violence. And I think it's possible. Are we smart or not? Are we intelligent or are we not? Are we good people? Do we have souls? Yes, we do. We can make that happen. We don't have to be violent. We don't have to go nuts and shoot a bunch of children on an island. Go crazy.
Breivik style, right? Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I understand where that fellow came from. I can't countenance that, though.
Well, he's another one of these misguided. He's pro-Israel for one, and then he's going and shooting his own ethnic Norwegians. I don't see how that's going to help anything. So it's obviously, who knows, right? It could be any kind of incentive behind that gentleman, or he's been used in different capacities. I'm not sure about that, but mm-hmm. Oh my God, talk about a misdirected individual, you know?
Yeah, if one really believes in conspiracies, one could say he was a robot or a false flagger, basically
sure.
trying to
yep.
start the other side moving. I've got this idea. I just had this thought. What if, I've told you that I don't consider myself an American any longer. I'm a white nationalist. I have fellow citizens in Europe, in Australia, in Canada, in New Zealand, and Ireland, and places like that. But I'm no longer consider myself an American. I'm a white nationalist. What if, in keeping with my nonviolent nature, what if we formed a brigade of white nationalists, and we would, those who can't afford it, we would have a fund for them. And whenever something pops up, whether it's Golden Dawn in Greece that needs help, or whether it's the identitary movement in France that needs help, we would send 500 from all over the world of people just like ourselves to join them shoulder to shoulder to increase our strength. In other words, nonviolence to a point. In other words, I'm not a pacifist. Someone strikes me, they will probably be stricken back. But as long as we are not met with violence, we would never commit violence. But a group that would meet when the occasions demanded it and throw our allegiance in with them, our brother and sisterhood with them, so that we no longer stand alone on these isolated islands of white nationalism. That's just a thought I had. Maybe it'll happen someday. Those who can't afford to travel, we can the ones who can't afford, can't leave, we can help fund their way over. But
the fact is that, you know, to kind of pick up on what you mentioned there, that the governments in the countries where we live are in fact they've given up on the idea of helping us and protecting us. I mean, it's like numerous examples around Europe, and I think it's the same in America. But even the idea that the native population in some of these countries, who can take Sweden as an example, we're not protected at all under the same types of laws that other immigrants are. I mean, and this is just insane. Specifically when it comes to hate speech laws, but other things as well, where we, for example, the government is now subsidizing people to companies and stuff like that to hire non-ethnic Swedes, for example, and these are, they're not economic incentives to push white Swedish people out of the picture. And when things like this start to happen, it's kind of our own, I guess, affirmative action to a certain degree. But when this kind of things start to happen, it's not only understandable, it would be wise and intelligent to arrange something where we no longer stand on our own, outed by our own governments that we ultimately fund, and standing with our pants down and not being able to do anything about what's occurring to us. I think that this is going to lead to a formulation of something, hopefully, that is far better and far more efficient than the crumbling governments that we unfortunately continue to fund right now.
You know, are you fairly aware of the American system and the American politicians? Do you, if I talk about the American Congress, do you know what I'm talking about as far as the people who make up the American Congress?
I have a pretty good outline, I guess. Yeah.
Are they the same suspects in Sweden?
Yeah.
Okay. Are they trained SEALs? Basically, these are the ones that legislate the anti-white laws, but they take their orders from above. Is it the same situation in Sweden?
Sure. Oh yeah, of course, definitely. And I think in this case, I think a lot of the people doing that are largely influenced not by what other politicians say and everything like that. It's more kind of it's a cultural environment. It's the media. It's what, you know, people get indoctrinated with what they should do. Political correctness, cultural Marxism. It's so they're so they're marinated in that type of environment that whatever they do on legislation wise, they cannot extend themselves outside of that or rationally think about what they're actually doing. So in my view, and in some cases, of course, it's just hands-on orders from above. So yes, absolutely.
And they do this without any conscience or without any hesitation. They actually enact these laws. Is there any blowback, any pushback from the people themselves that are affected, impacted by these anti-white laws?
Not yet, I'd say. I mean, again, there are tendencies and people beginning to speak up. So, I mean, I'm aware of it, but that's because I'm, you're more familiar with some of the counter arguments because you've been, we've been observing the insanity for such a long time. But on a large scale, on a more official level, they do everything they can to hold any kind of voices of criticism out of the media in any capacity. If there's a politician that shows up that has some, sentiments that speak against the current wisdom of our times and political correctness, they're very quickly outed. But underneath that surface, though, Tom, I definitely say that the environment is a pressure cooker, and it's starting to boil. People see what's going on. They see they're being disenfranchised. They realize, the predicament they're in. And the resistance, you do see that reflected in, for example, that the Swedish Democrats is probably slated to become the third largest party right now, and they're more anti-immigrant. They have some more basis in some kind of sanity as opposed to all the other seven parties. And I mean, for them to make that progress by just coming into effect in our political mainstream establishment around 2010. And to make that leap to become, I mean, it's not finished yet, but there's an election here soon and in late September. And for them to have advanced in such a capacity of becoming probably, the third or fourth largest party in Sweden, that speak volumes about what people really are thinking, no matter what they're saying or anything like that. So there is encouragement there. They're anti-European Union, but they're pro-European, So I think it's great.
Is there enough time? Is there enough time in Sweden?
I don't know. I say there's always time. It doesn't matter how bad it is, because it can always get worse. But it has to work,
It has to, yes. And something else, the power of extremism and the utility of extremism. Every time someone makes a pro-Swedish, a pro-nativist, pro-native Swede comment, he should be applauded to the rafters. And also something a little bit further, a little more extreme. Extreme, not to us, but extreme to the Swedish people. For instance, if a lawmaker would someday stand up and for the people that are dispossessed, you Swedes, stand up and say something, then encourage him to say something even greater or more extreme. Never accept the status quo, because that's a recipe for death. Extremism has its own, I'm at a loss for words. I think you know what I mean, though. We're at a position where we have to take it a little bit further every time, because we're so far behind. We have been asleep, and our fathers and our grandfathers were asleep all these years. Yeah. Allowed this to happen because we trusted in our leaders. And I don't think the Swedes are any different from the Americans. We thought, hey, we're in good hands. We can continue to work and create a beautiful civilization, have two cars, take vacations, because we've got good leaders. Well, that was the wrong attitude, because mm-hmm. the leaders weren't good leaders. They were the worst leaders. They had the interests of others at mind. And so we have to make up for lost ground. We cannot just simply pass a law. Let's just say tomorrow, a Swedish legislature passes a law, no more immigrants from anywhere. Well, that's not good enough, because you've already got, a sixth, a tenth of your population right now is from another nation?
Yeah, I think 16 to 18%, I believe it is.
Yeah, well, you either have to develop a South African type of enclave, a nation for them there, or they have to go elsewhere. They have to get out. If it was difficult moving from their nation, as they always say, well, it won't be as difficult leaving Sweden again, or America, or France. Certainly, they can go back to where they came from. This idea of them staying there, it's not going to make it. We're still going to lose in that one.
Well, I mean, it's a different. Do you see how things have changed over the years in terms of what this was meant to be? Because at the same time, we have organizations like AIPAC, of course, running foreign policy, which is leading a lot of people to having to flee from their countries, and therefore we're you know, we become those who admit to the asylum seekers. But then at the same time, it has not developed into a place where you help people out in the intermedium. You realize that they're fleeing from horrible conditions and you know, things like that. But then there's no plan to kind of restore that. This is replacement level migration, and that's what people have to understand. And when we take into account the birth rates of Europeans versus, let's say, primarily Muslims, but certainly other as well, it's so diametrically opposed that we'll see a tremendous change in only 2 to 3 generations, where we have Swedish politicians now even openly talking about, like, oh, when we become a minority, you know, in our own country, we would do good treating the Muslims, you know, good, because then they'll take care of us. I mean, I'm not joking. I've actually heard politicians speaking like this on state TV, you know, and it's such a, you know, you realize that, my God, these people are so gone, they're so far removed on any kind of stability and sanity here, that I don't know what to do. We have to just get those people out of politics. There's no other way about it, you know?
The fact is, in Sweden or America, our worst enemies are leading us. They're in charge. They're in control right now. Even if this man meant what he said, this legislature, this politician, about almost seeming glad that he and his native Swedes would be a minority very soon in Sweden, as if that's a great thing. He's either lying, or he's ignorant, or he knows what he's saying is false, and yet he's got to say it because he wants to keep his job. Well, there is a special place for people like that, and we have got to get control of ourselves before we get control of the Jewish operators of Europe and America. We have got to deal with the traitors in our midst.
Yeah.
These people, America is the greatest example I've got. Clowns, idiots like Romney, who ran in, Mitt Romney ran in the last election, Israeli first from top to bottom, a neocon warmonger.
Yeah.
They're going to run that character in the next election along with Hillary Clinton. This is all they're giving us to choose from.
It's sad, you know.
God. Yeah, these clowns, these trained SEALs, they're going to get theirs. They're going to live in mansions. They're going to be protected with guards and stuff. The rest of us have to. I don't know what's going to trigger this. What's going to trip the wire? What's finally going to send us over the top? But we're getting ourselves in a very good position right now to react when something does happen. I'm not talking about violence either. I'm talking about being able to move ahead with speed.
Well, taking control of our own countries again.
Absolutely.
For Christ's sake. You know, it's like I think that this has to be done, because there's no end in sight. This insanity will just continue and continue. Sweden is slated to receive over 1 million immigrants in the next 5 years. There's not even, I mean, they're taking so many in that they're living on camping grounds. The immigration industry, as they call it in Sweden, where these, small business owners that own like a little bit of property or some camping trailers or whatever, are like, they're getting fat and rich off of the immigration, policies that are being run. Even lawyers, even to that extent, where lawyers who are dealing with asylum seekers are getting that money from the government to handle these cases, for example. it's insanity. And this will never, it will never stop. And unless we put the foot down and say, no, thank you, we've had enough, nothing is going to happen, you know, it's just going to continue.
Yeah. That is, we're both laughing, but we're really not finding anything funny in that. I don't know. We can look to France, the gains they've made there. I think there's some hope also in Hungary. At the end of the day, it's still us. Basically, we cannot tolerate this anymore, the situation. Let's put it this way. What would Swedes do? Let's say the Swedes who are like yourself, racially aware, conscious of their impending doom, could Could you Swedes secede peacefully from the rest of the nation and form your own enclave and defy anybody who comes into it? Is that going to happen, or would Sweden's military come in and crush you?
Yeah, I'm wondering about that too. To be honest, I don't have a good sense of things. What is the talk like within the military? I mean, obviously they're responding to the politicians. They're very law abiding. But at the same time, some part of me is like, maybe they're sitting there and just like literally thinking about like overthrowing the government and getting, you know, good people in place. I mean, the problem is that they're very, very authoritarian. They bow down to, you know, whatever they say is supposed to happen. And at this rate, as far as I'm concerned, I think they would turn the guns on their own population. I think that they would, if someone tried to do something in that capacity, they would send in the military and take care of business Waco style, unfortunately. But I might be wrong, see, because I'm not really good in tapping that environment. It's a very hush-hush environment in Sweden, and you don't really know. People are not outspoken on the same level. So there's a silence there, which ultimately works against us because we don't know what people are thinking, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, in America, yes, it's there's no doubt in my mind if, let's say, a group of Americans actually did try to set up their own enclave, no doubt in my mind they would send in the American mercenaries, and they would kill fellow Americans as quick as you can eat popcorn.
Can you imagine what would happen when that is found out, though? That would be the interesting thing. Unfortunately, I don't like people being sacrificed and whatnot, but I'm just saying, if the government turned that way on the American people, I think that there's enough fire in Americans still that they would they'd get real damn mad about that, right?
Yes, and I'll say this. The thing going for America that you may not have in Sweden, I don't know if you have people living in the woods yet. I don't think you've got people employed like we have in America, white Americans. I don't think you've got people who have been totally disenfranchised and dispossessed as we have in America. We've got a tremendous undercurrent of white Americans that, I hate to say it, but they're turning to dope. They're turning to meth. They're turning to cocaine up their nose because there's no hope anywhere else. This at least gives them a little sanctuary for a few hours. But I don't think that's the case in Sweden. In fact, I told you I was in Sweden about a month and a half ago. Sweden is still, I find it extremely beautiful country. I've been to Gothenburg before. In fact, one of the hottest days I ever spent in my life was in Gothenburg. A lot of folks think that Sweden's always cold. I'll tell you
what. No, not always. No.
It can get very hot.
Summer's all nice and long, and yeah, it's great summertime, you know?
Beautiful. The pine trees and the islands and the blue water. I don't see the Swedes becoming so disgruntled. As long as they have a full refrigerator and a full belly and lots of soccer, football, yeah. And maybe that's not necessary for a revolt, for a revolution of ideas, if not guns. Maybe it's imperative that your people suffer even more, which may seem hard right now. But you've got to prepare still for that day when it does happen. And I think that's what you're all about. We've got to have a framework ready and in place so that people, we don't lose so many people just searching for you. You're going to be there. They'll know it. Unless the government puts you out of business. And that's a possibility, but you can always move to Norway or maybe Iceland.
I'd be interested in Iceland. I've actually never visited there. It's one of those places I've just haven't managed to get there yet, but it seems like an interesting place. I'm still wrapping my head a little bit around what kind of politics they have there and everything else, actually. But
I love it. I've been there three times.
Oh, great.
Iceland, it's all white. Only in the airport terminal, I think, will you find a black working at one of the stands there. But it's a tough environment, but the people are lovely. They're beautiful. Huge people, enormous people. I mean,
some giants there. Oh, yeah.
I'm 6'1", or I was. I don't know what I am now, but I'm a short guy in Iceland. There's some big people. But no, lovely people. It's a large island. There are trees there for people who think it's nothing but forbidding tundra. But Unless Sweden probably has some harsh economic situation, it may never happen. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. we've had that though. That's why I think you see the reflection in the uprise with the Swedish Democrats, because people are they're sick and tired of it, and you have that sentiment there. And see, I think they're very quiet and very kind of laid back, but once they've crossed that threshold, you know, then things could go pretty quick actually after that point. And that's something we have to kind of, you know, continue to encourage. I get, I mean, I hate to be defeatist in terms of, okay, let's kind of sit around and wait for the catastrophe to occur and then we can do something. I mean, I think it's work on every single level to regain sanity in our political system and to retake control of our own countries and begin to making judgments and situations that are actually for the people and not against them. I mean, I think that's pretty sound ideas, you know, but today they've managed to somehow to seem like that's extremist or whatever. But the more they're pushing those kinds of issues, the more saturated these kinds of responses become. And eventually they lose their value and people don't care anymore. They know what they know. They see what they see. They've seen their country change so much and they're ready for something different, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it may be then that next million people that they're that politicians bragging about so much that actually turns the clock, so to speak, or trips the wire that makes Swedes realize. But on the other hand, it may have to be a saturation similar to what's occurring and what's occurred in France. It may be something so simple as white youth being beaten up by dark youth, being unable to live, unable to move without being facing a mugging or a assault of some sort. When you start getting beat up, when you start losing a few teeth to these new Swedes or these new French or these new Americans, there's no smiley face, no happy face you can put on that. Suddenly you become very angry. You know, America has abandoned its white youth. We did that back in the 1960s and 70s when we integrated our schools here. And we have totally abandoned a couple of generations of white kids. Now I think we're seeing the blowback. A lot of these kids are some of our strongest, most racially conscious people in America right now. They're tired of the BS. They know they've been lied. They hate authority with a passion. On the other hand, let me say this. These kids, once they kick the dope habit, once they get their lives straight, are going to be a force to reckon with. Right now, I've got to tell you, in the last couple of years, I have met some of the most amazing, talented, intelligent people in this movement. I never dreamed. There's a stereotypical character in America, a redneck. He's supposed to wave a rebel flag and drink beer and be ignorant and toothless. And that may have been true at one time. I'm not sure, but it damn sure is not true now. We have some of the most incredibly talented and versatile people. You know, we're talking artists, we're talking major movers and shakers right now that are coming to our side. And a lot of these people have reached the acme of fame and fortune. And they said, that's not good enough. I need something in my life, something meaningful. They know what's going on. They know what's rotten right now. And they're like us. They're absolutely like us. They don't like it. They don't want to become extinct. They like what the Wright brothers did by being the first to fly an airplane. And they like what Christian Barnard did in South Africa with the first heart transplant. And they, you know what I'm saying?
Sure,
They think that's too good to give up. And God bless their hearts. Honestly, it's an exciting time. If it's nothing else, Henrik, we can admit to each other that it's better to live in exciting times like this than to be bored to death. Just die of dullness.
Exactly. No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. No, I think you're right. I think we're, you know, in for some interesting times, and I think we've seen good kind of political uprising, at least in Europe, at this stage of just kind of being sick and tired of the globalism and the European Union and everything else that they've shoved down our throats, you know, against our will and all that. So I think we're indeed in for some interesting times here. But Tom, I know we could continue for a lot longer. There's just so much going on, so much things we could discuss and break down and talk about. But maybe we can have you back again in the future and talk about some of the other things we didn't get to hear, both pertaining to the book Hellstorm, of course, but also to some of the other works you have out there and the the issue of Japan and how the Japanese were treated. I'm really interested in that, and I think our audience would enjoy hearing more about that as well. So we'd love to have you back if you want to, Tom, in the future. But for this time, as we begin to kind of wrap things up for now, give us your details again. Tell us about the website, if there's any other way, you know, either if people can reach you or something like that, if they want to get a hold of you, or if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with. The floor is yours. So please go ahead, Tom.
Well, anyone who wants to get a hold of me, just drop me a line, M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, Goodrich. That's mtgoodrich@aol.com. And yeah, I'd love to hear. I'd love to hear what you have to say, even if it's critical of me. I'm open to debate. But I've got to tell you, Henry, thanks so much for having me. You are a gentleman, and I never assumed anything different. You are a gifted individual. You're one of the individuals I was talking about this incredibly talented bunch of people right now that are coming together. You are going to stand out in my life. I will not forget this interview, and hopefully, yes, you can have me back. You can have me back anytime you want me.
Great. Thank you.
Except tonight or tomorrow. We'll make it a little bit in between.
Need to rest your voice a little bit first. Yeah, I got it.
And we can talk about anything you want to talk about.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate that. And thank you for your work, and thank you for digging in the way you have, you know, with the book Hellstorm. And the subtitle is The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947. In dedication to the people who were lost and everything else. And it's just an immense topic, which I urge people, which I think people should know about, so that you also can get some balance in your life and put World War II in context and realize what actually has happened and what has been going on there. So I urge you to check out the book. It's well worth it. Yes, it's heavy. Yes, it's very, very, you know, difficult to a certain extent to read through, but it's important. I think this is something that we deserve to all human beings, you know, who have been slaughtered in these kinds of ways through the different modalities that we see in the world. But yeah, so pick up a copy of that, and we'll have some links to the other books as well by Tom on the website. So check that out, folks. Thank you so much again, Tom. We'll stay in touch, and have a good day. Thank you.
You too, Henry. Thanks.
And thank you for staying with us today. Some heavy topics here, but I don't think it's a necessity to discuss and talk about these, to get it out in the open, air out the lies, examine the history, and to do so with an objective of looking at the accounts that exist out there and letting them lead wherever they may lead. We have much more coming, of course. We'll be back with Frank Salter. We also have Kai Murrows, John DeNugent, Kevin MacDonald, Dennis Fetcho, Michael Hoffman, John Rappaport, and Veronica Clark. We appreciate your dedication and interest, as always. Thank you for listening today, and thank you for your membership. We'll be back in just a few days. Until then, take good care of yourself, and of course, your family and loved ones. And also, don't forget to learn to love yourself, your culture, your heritage, and be proud of who you are. All right, folks, thank you for listening. We'll talk to you soon.